supersingular elliptic curves modulo a large prime with L isogeny. So I'll explain all of that when I get to it. Okay, so first of all, some background. A couple of years ago at the crypto conference in Santa Barbara, the rump session, there were some pretty surprising results announced. A group of researchers from China, headed by Professor Wang, had found collisions in some of the most commonly used hash functions. So just to give you an idea, at the hash function workshop last month, someone from Microsoft spoke about how they'd been looking for instances of MD5, one of these hash functions, in the Microsoft code. And they found something like 780 different ways and different places in the source code in which this particular hash function was used. So as you can imagine, finding collisions in this hash function is a pretty serious problem. So the MD4, MD5, several others have already found collisions, and then very quickly, some of the ideas were used by other people, including Antoine Zhu, to get new kind of attacks on SHA-0 and SHA-1. And although the next family of SHA hash functions has not yet been attacked, it's now under serious reconsideration whether this is something that's going to be secure, you know, 25, 50 years into the future. So this is a pretty big issue. And as Tanya said, these are hash functions which are not public key. They don't have any particular structure or principles behind them that people have been able to identify as of yet. So NIST has been organizing a series of workshops now to address this issue and to try to think about what should be the principles underlying the design of a new hash function. So we've had two workshops so far. There's going to be, I believe, another workshop and a competition coming up in a couple of years, analogous to the competition that was done for AES for block ciphers a few years back. Okay, so I haven't said, first of all, what a hash function is. Very generically, a hash function just maps bit strings of some finite length to bit strings of some other finite length. But when we talk about cryptographic hash functions, what we're really interested in is, well, first of all, a hash function needs to be easy to compute because it comes up everywhere and you need to be able to compute it quickly without it having to cost you a lot of computation time. But I'm also, in this talk, only talking about unkeyed hash functions. In other words, anybody could compute it. You just specify what the hash function is and you don't need a secret key to compute it. Secret key hash functions, for example, like message authentication codes, MACs. So the whole theory of MACs is completely separate here from here. But the cryptographic hash function part that we're talking about, we're really talking about wanting hash functions which are collision resistant. So what do I mean by collision resistant? You could probably imagine a hash function is said to be collision resistant if it's computationally infeasible to find two inputs that hash to the same output. So if you find two inputs that are distinct that hash to the same output, that's called a collision. Okay, and so an even stronger property, which is very nice, is pre-image resistance, which is that given an output, it should be computationally infeasible to find a corresponding input that would hash to that particular output. Well, obviously, if you can solve the second problem, you can solve the first, because you could just take any x, plug it into your hash function, get h of x, and then just use the algorithm for the second problem to find an output y which hashes to that same value. Yes, it could be. Then it would not be a collision, yeah, but probabilistically it would not be the same. Okay, so what do we mean by a provable hash function? The overall goal is to construct efficiently computable collision-resistant hash functions. However, as I said, with regard to the hash functions that are in wide use today, MD4, MD5, MD5 actually, and the family of SHA hash functions, there are the principles underlying them, why they were supposed to be collision resistant, are unclear. So one idea is to try to make hash functions which are the collision resistance is reducible to the hardness of solving some well-known math problem. And if you have a proof like that, then you say, then you may feel more comfortable because you may think, okay, well, if finding a collision in this hash function is as easy as hard as factoring, inputs of a certain length or as hard as discrete log, then we feel more confident that you won't be able to find collisions. So that's what we mean by a provable hash function. If to compute a collision is to solve some other well-known hard problem, such as factoring or discrete log. So let me just mention some recent related work that, in fact, there's provable hashes going back quite a number of years, but most recently, hash function's been proposed called VSH, very smooth hash, I think, by Contini, Lenstra, and Steinfeld. There's also, I've seen a proposal, I don't know who it's due to, for an elliptic curve discrete log-based hash function, so the difficulty of solving the collision problem in that hash is equivalent to solving the discrete log problem in an elliptic curve. Other hash functions going back that are more related to what I'll be talking about today, Zemmer and Tillich, and follow-up work by Joie and Kiskaté and Liardet, all have thought about this a special case of the idea that I'm going to talk about today. So I'll mention that their work again at the end. And Goldreich also in a preprint. Okay, so let's talk about what we're proposing here. The construction of the hash function that we're proposing is to take a k-regular graph, G. So a graph is just a collection of vertices connected by some edges that are specified. We say a graph is k-regular if out of each vertex you have exactly k edges coming, emanating from that vertex. Now, each vertex in the graph should have a label. That's going to be part of our setup. And so the input to the hash function is just some bit string. So how are we going to use this input to get an output for our hash function? We are going to divide the input string up into blocks and use those blocks as a way to walk around the graph. So, for example, if you have, let's say, a choice coming out of every vertex, let's say it's a three regular graph, and we never want to go backwards in the graph. So from each vertex, that once you arrive at a vertex, you have two choices of which next edge to pick, because you're not going to go backwards along the edge that you came along. So that choice is specified by one bit. So in the input string, you could read off the bits one bit at a time, and each bit causes you to choose your next step in the graph. So from wherever you are at a vertex, you use that next bit in the input string to decide which next vertex to go to. Okay, so if you had a larger k and more choices of edges to follow, then you would take a larger chunk of the input string to read off which step to take next in your walk on the graph. Okay, and I also, like I said, no backtracking is allowed. Okay, so the output of the hash function would then be just the label of the final vertex of the walk. So just the very simple idea is that you start somewhere on a graph at some vertex, you get an input string that's basically, you could think of that as directions for how to walk around the graph, and then your walk ends and you're standing at some vertex and that's the output of your hash function. Okay, and so this could be done for any graph. And the idea is very simple and it's very well known to complexity theory people. I mean, the idea of using random walks on expander graphs is very standard in complexity theory as a good source of pseudo-randomness. So that there's kind of two properties here which are, as far as we know, basically independent. The one property is the idea of using an expander graph. I'll say more about what an expander graph is, but to produce basically pseudo-random outputs. That's what you want when you're trying to produce a good hash function. And then the second part of the idea is that you want to have this collision resistance, so you actually want the problem of finding a collision in such a hash function to be related to some hard problem in mathematics. And those are separate properties or qualities that we'll be talking about. Okay, so the question is, are there graphs such that finding collisions is hard? So finding distinct paths between vertices. Another way to say that is, in an undirected graph anyway, you want a graph such that finding cycles is hard, finding any cycle. Okay, so for example, a really bad idea for a graph to use would be the hypercube. The hypercube is such a nice, easy graph to use because the routing is incredibly easy. You read off from the label of the vertex exactly how to get from there to any other vertex. It's just the hypercube, meaning a cube in n dimensions, and then the graph would have 2 to the n vertices. Okay, there's obviously some graphs which we definitely don't want to use. Also, finding cycles is pretty easy. Okay, so what kind of graph should we use? So random walks on expanded graphs mix very rapidly. This is this property of pseudorandomness that I was talking about. If you have an expanded graph with n vertices, the nice property that it has is that a short walk, meaning a walk of length log n steps, already approximates the uniform distribution. Okay, so I'm going to say a little bit more about what expander graphs are, and so then this property should be a little bit more clear. And then Ramanujan graphs are actually optimal expander graphs, and there you start to see some connection with number theory, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later too. Okay, so to find a collision in this hash function would simply mean to walk around the graph kind of in two different ways from two arbitrary vertices. So that's why I said that we want a graph in which it's hard to find cycles, because once you can find a cycle, then you can create two paths that collide. Okay, so just a review. Many of you may know all about expander graphs, but just as a reminder, let's let G be the graph with vertex set V and edge set E. So, I guess I already said what K regular is. Each vertex has K edges coming out of it. An expander graph with N vertices has an expansion constant C, some constant bigger than 0, less than 1, actually. If for any subset U of the graph, of the vertex set of the graph V of size less than or equal to half the number of vertices in the graph, if the boundary of that set U, which means all the neighbors of the set U minus the members of the set U, has size greater than or equal to C times the size of U. So the idea of this is that when you look at neighbors of small sets, they grow in some constant proportional way. And the nice thing about that is that it means that you kind of, if you're taking a walk, you can kind of quickly get anywhere on the graph if you have a good expansion constant. It also, for example, implies that the graph is connected. Okay, so the adjacency matrix of a graph is just the matrix whose entries are, the ijth entry is the number of vertices connecting the ith vertex, or sorry, the number of edges connecting the ith vertex and the jth vertex. And the adjacency matrix of an undirected graph is symmetric, and so all the eigenvalues are real, and we can order them. And for a connected k-regular graph, the largest eigenvalue is k, and the others are strictly smaller. So the expansion constant can also be represented algebraically in terms of these eigenvalues. And this is, I believe, a theorem due to Alain, that the constant C is greater than or equal to 2 times k minus mu 1 over 3k minus 2 mu 1. Well, the The upshot of that inequality is that the smaller the eigenvalue mu 1, the better the expansion constant. So what if we're constructing a graph and we want it to be a good expander graph, we'd like to go for having kind of as large of an eigenvalue gap as we can. Okay, so that is the segue to the definition of Ramanujan graphs. That so how big exactly can we make that that eigenvalue gap? So a theorem of Alan and Bopana says that if you have a sequence, an infinite family of connected K regular graphs with the number of vertices going to infinity, then the lim-inf of the mu 1, the first eigenvalue, it has to be greater than or equal to 2 times the square root of k minus 1. So this is telling you, at least in the limit, a bound on what that gap can look like. So that motivates the definition of Ramanujan graphs, where a k-regular connected graph is said to be Ramanujan if the second eigenvalue, the mu 1, satisfies the inequality mu 1 is less than or equal to 2 times square root of k minus 1. Okay, so finally here we start to come to the example of the graph of supersingular elliptic curves modulo p. Okay, so first let me say here that I had a few PowerPoint problems and I was not able to make the symbol fp squared on my slides. So when we say fp, when we say modulo p, we're talking about supersingular curves in characteristic p, meaning over a finite field. But it's known that such curves, just take the whole collection of them that are a priori defined over fp bar. But we know that they're actually all defined over fp squared. So whenever I say mod p here, I mean the collection of supersingular elliptic curves which are defined either over fp or over fp squared. And there's roughly square root of p of them that are defined over fp. And there's roughly p over 12 of them total. So most of them are defined over fp squared, not over fp. Okay, so now we're going to make a graph out of this collection of objects. And this was proposed by Pizer. It may have been considered earlier, but it was written down in several articles by Pizer. The vertices of our graph are going to be this collection of members of this collection of supersingular elliptic curves, mod p. The curves, as I said, are defined at most over fp squared, and they're labeled by their j invariants. So this is very convenient that we have a very nice name for each one of these vertices, and it's the j invariant of the elliptic curve. Okay, so I didn't think in this audience that I needed to say what a supersingular elliptic curve was, but then I thought it was silly since I was saying what an expander graph is. I might as well say what a supersingular elliptic curve is. So elliptic curves we usually think of as being defined by some Weierstrass equation over a finite field. So y squared equals f of x, f some cubic with discriminant which is co-prime to p. And then if we say that the curve is supersingular if it has no p torsion over any extension. So the other way to think of the vertices of this graph, and there is a very strong reason for thinking of it this way, and I'll explain a little bit more. The vertices can also be thought about as maximal orders in a quaternion algebra. And the reason for that is that the endomorphism ring of a supersingular elliptic curve in characteristic P is a maximal order in BP infinity, which is the unique up to isomorphism quaternion algebra over Q, which is unramified outside the prime P and infinity. So you could think of these vertices either as elliptic curves labeled by their J invariant, or you could think of them as maximal orders in this quaternion algebra BP infinity. And I'll say a little bit more later about why you might want to think about them in the second context if you're thinking about attacking this hash function. On the other hand, it's known that, or at least up until now, there is no good algorithm for going back and forth between an elliptic, a supersingular elliptic curve and its endomorphism ring. The best algorithms for going back and forth between these two sides of the picture are exponential and peak. So the number of vertices, I already said that the, this is, follows from the mass formula, that the number of vertices in this graph is roughly p over 12. So when you think about cryptographic applications, if you want to have, say, 128 bits of security against attack, for example, you might think about taking p to be of size 256 bits, roughly. So that's kind of the minimum size p that we're talking about here. You can't take p equal to 2 or 3 or something like that. If p is 2, there's only one, for obviously small p, there's only, there's a unique supersingular elliptic curve. Okay, so a little bit more about this Pizer graph. So how do we actually make the graph? The edges between vertices are going to be L isogenies. So actually, if you think of the L torsion over the algebraic closure, you think of the L torsion as being Z mod L cross Z mod L. And you can see that there's actually L plus 1 distinct subgroups of size L in that group. So this graph is K regular, where K is L plus 1. So from each, that follows from something I'm going to say on the next slide. Let me just state it as a fact. I'm not going to say anything about the proof, but this graph is actually Ramanujan. So this follows from results of Eichler and Shimura, and it's undirected if we assume P is congruent to 1 mod 12. Okay, so I mentioned the word isogeny on the last slide, but I didn't say anything about what it is. Most of you, I'm sure, know. But so an isogeny is a surjective homomorphism from one elliptic curve to another. I'm restricting to the context of elliptic curves. And it's has the property that, for separable isogenies anyway, the degree of the isogeny is the size of the kernel. So at first you might just think, okay, this is some map of elliptic curves, which is a homomorphism. But actually, all isogenies can be characterized as being written as going from an elliptic curve to the quotient of that elliptic curve by some subgroup. That's why I was counting subgroups of Z mod L cross Z mod L. So to construct an L isogeny from an elliptic curve to another, we take a subgroup scheme of size L and take the quotient. Okay, so I mean, that seems pretty abstract. You just have some, an elliptic curve is really a group, it's a group scheme, you take some subgroup scheme, you take a quotient, and you don't even know really what is that an elliptic curve again? Well, it turns out that it is, again, an elliptic curve, and the formula, both for the isogeny and for the equation of the new elliptic curve that you get by quotienting, is given by Velu. Formula is given by Velu. These are actually very old, I think from the 70s. Forget. Okay, so just to convince you that moving around this graph is actually a very easy, kind of efficient thing to do, let me just write down the special case of Velu's formulas when L is equal to 2. So here we're talking about a three-regular graph, and if, say, you start at an elliptic curve E1, which has Weierstrass equation y squared equals x cubed plus a4x plus a6, with j invariant given by this formula, that would be its label. In a priori, that's an element of fp squared, with a4 and a6 are defined over fp squared. Now, if we want L equal 2, we want a subgroup of size 2. So that really just means one 2-torsion point plus the point at infinity. So a 2-torsion point looks like I'm using Q to be both the point R, 0 and the subgroup I called Q as well. So the elliptic curve E2, which is the quotient of E1 by the subgroup Q is given by the equation y squared equals x cubed minus 4a4 plus 15r squared times x plus 8a6 minus 14r cubed. So I just wrote that down so that you could see very explicitly how easy it is to compute the next step in the walk. If you start at E1 and you want to compute the J invariant of E2, you first compute these coefficients, and then you have the J invariant of the next step. Now, of course, when you're doing the hash function, you don't need to compute the J invariant at each step. You can just keep walking until the end and then compute the J invariant of the final output. But what I was hiding here a little bit is the computation of this two torsion point. So that's actually what makes the hash function the most costly, is the fact that start with an elliptic curve, you have some fixed starting point, let's say, and you can find a, you know, do a one-time operation to find one of the three two torsion points for your original elliptic curve. Now, once you've moved to the next elliptic curve, one thing that you could do is remember that you don't want to backtrack. So you can figure out which of the three two torsion points corresponds to the backtracking, and keep track of that route that you already know from the fact that you know where you came from. And so now you have a cubic. This is a cubic. You need the two torsion points, so you need the roots of this cubic, but you already know one of them. So really what you're doing here is you need to factor a quadratic. So at each step, you need to perform a square root computation, and that's the dominant step in computing this hash function, is computing that square root at each point. Okay, so the equation for the isogeny is also given very explicitly from Bayleu's formulas like this, although we don't really actually need the equation for the isogeny. So this might be a good point for me to say, I mean, many people, when you think about supersingular elliptic curves in cryptography, you think, oh, well, you know, thank you, but no thank you. We don't want to expose ourselves to any extra risk by doing something special. And there's known attacks for supersingular elliptic curves that make them seem kind of suspect. Well, in this case, there certainly could be something special about them, but they actually seem to be kind of more difficult or more challenging to attack in this context than ordinary elliptic curves. And the reason is what I said about the endomorphism ring. So the endomorphism ring here, instead of being an order in an imaginary quadratic field, we have that it's a maximal order in some rank 4 quaternion algebra. And so instead of having the problem of something which would basically be like the discrete log problem in the class group of a number field, now we have some analog of that which is not even in a group. We don't really have a class group in the context of maximal orders in a quaternion algebra, and we have the objects of study are these rank 4 algebras. So in that sense, it seems that the problem may be harder than the discrete log problem in the class group of a number field. Okay, so let's talk about collision resistance a little bit. So finding collisions reduces to finding isogenies between elliptic curves, in the sense that here we have this graph, and if you want to find a collision, what you want is to find any two vertices with two distinct paths between them. So the collision is finding the two distinct paths between any two vertices, which can also be thought of as a cycle by reversing the second path. And the pre-image resistance is finding any path between two given vertices, meaning there's some starting point, some starting vertex for the hash function, and then there is some output that you're given that corresponds to one of the vertices in the graph. So those are two specified vertices in the graph. And in order to find a preimage, it would be a string x, which when you fed it into the hash function would take you from the first vertex to the second vertex. That string x corresponds to a path in this graph. So it's a choice at each vertex of one of the edges to follow to continue to get to the endpoint that you desire. Okay, so far the best known attack on this construction is the birthday attack. So you kind of expect that if you did a random walk, since the output approximates the uniform distribution, you kind of expect that you might get a collision in something like square root of the number of vertices. That's why we picked to start with P to be roughly the size 2 to the 256 bits. Okay, so what are the hard problems here? What are we saying? Why is this? In what sense is this a provable hash? Okay, so the problem number one, just reformulating what I've just said, is that to produce a collision is to produce a pair of supersingular elliptic curves over FP squared and two distinct isogenies of degree L to the N between them. And N here we can think of as being something like on the order of log P. So let's say N is roughly 256. Okay. Sorry? L equals 2 would be the most efficient way. Sorry. L equals 2 is the case in which it's most efficient to take each step of the walk, but you have to take more steps if you take L equals 2. So another way to phrase this same problem is, given E, a supersingular elliptic curve, find an endomorphism E of degree L to the 2n, not the multiplication by L to the n map. Okay, so this is the cycle that you would get if you followed your two paths, one path in one direction and the other path in the other direction. Okay, so this is the equivalence between problem one and problem two is the reason that I mentioned, is one of the reasons that I mentioned this, the fact that the vertices can be thought of as maximal orders in a quaternion algebra. Because if you think of this problem in the, suppose you could translate from the elliptic curves and their J invariants over to maximal orders in a quaternion algebra, then this problem, you would rephrase it in the following way. You would say, finding an if you need to find an endomorphism that actually which has degree L to the 2n, what you're actually looking for in the quaternion algebra is an element of the quaternions which has norm L to the 2n. And so this is, you know, representing this L to the 2n as in some way by this norm form. However, even if you can represent this L to the 2n by this norm form easily, which you certainly can in some cases, the problem is translating that back into an endomorphism and then translating that back into a path on this graph. Okay, so then the third problem relates to preimage resistance. The preimage resistance can really be formulated as, given two supersingular elliptic curves, find an isogeny of degree L to the n between them. So this problem is obviously, just as preimage resistance implies collision resistance, or implies, a solution to preimage resistance implies a solution to collision resistance. If you can solve problem three, you can obviously solve problems one and two. Okay, so let me just say a little bit about the timings here. We implemented this hash function for primes of 192 bits and primes of 256 bits with L equals 2. And as I was just saying, if you take L equals 2, then you read off the input to the hash function bit by bit. So you're in some sense, you're not very efficient because you're not reading big chunks of the input at each time. You have to actually do n steps if your input has length n. However, As I showed you very explicitly, when L equals 2, it's very easy to write down the formulas for how to perform the steps in the walk. Okay, so the time per input bit for L equals 2 is 3.9 times 10 to the minus 5 seconds. Now, this implementation was just on a PC, I forget, like something like 3 gigahertz PC. And this is roughly the time that you see there is roughly just the time taken for a square root. If you have a faster square root or a special situation where square root is faster, then you would get better timings for this. Yeah, random P, random. So the hashing bandwidth there is not very good, roughly 25 kilobits per second. And the question is, okay, so this is a lot slower than any of the hash functions in use today. Is there any reason for doing something like this? Well, there are other provable hashes which are faster. For example, VSH is much faster. So there may not be any reason for doing this particular hash function in practice, but there may be a reason for choosing to use provable hash functions in practice, which is that if you really want to have some, you know, kind of confidence that cracking your hash function is a hard problem, then at least using a provable hash is a way to relate it to something that at least the mathematical community might think is a hard problem. So when the NIST and NSA are often very very concerned about matching the strengths of different algorithms. You use AES at a certain bit length, then you want to have if you're going to do a key exchange associated with that, you want the key exchange to have that same strength of security, and obviously then you also want to have your hash function have that same security strength. And that's hard to do if you don't know what the security strength of your hash function is. So with provable hash functions, in the context of, let's say, a protocol which is requiring a public key, say, key exchange anyway, it is actually reasonable to think about using hash functions at this speed, even if the speed looks very slow. Okay, so for the 256-bit primes, it's 7.6 times 10 to the minus 5 seconds. And, oh yeah, here it is, 2.6 gigahertz machine. Okay, so I've focused, partly because the topic of this workshop is elliptic curves, I focused on the graph of supersingular elliptic curves, mod P, and the implementation of the hash function in that context and the hard problem that we would be looking at solving in order to find collisions. However, you could think, as the title of the talk suggested, you could think of this construction as being more general, where really you can use it for any graph, or most likely expander graph, in which you think it's hard to find cycles. So now I don't know all that many graphs. I haven't thought about that many graphs, but maybe other people can think of good graphs. But the other main known construction of Ramanujan graphs is due to Lubotsky, Phillips, and Sarnak. And so that was the other main graph that we considered besides the supersingular elliptic curves graph. Okay, well, obviously the supersingular elliptic curves graph, you can vary P to vary the strength of it, and you can vary L, and that will vary the efficiency of it. Okay, so the Lubotsky, Phillips, and Sarnak were the first to come up with a deterministic construction of Ramanujan graphs. And that was the other reason why I mentioned the description of the supersingular graph in terms of the vertices being maximal orders in a quaternion algebra. Is you can really think of both of these constructions, the LPS graphs and the Pizer graph, as originating from the work of Ihara, where the idea, if you want to have really good expansion in your graph, I mean, one really good expander graph, quote unquote expander graph, is a tree. Just start with one vertex and then just emanating from that, you know, kind of you can quickly randomly get anywhere. But So to make this, the way that Ihara's construction goes is he starts with this kind of idyllic description of a tree and then takes a quotient by some, I don't know, maximal compact subgroup or something like that, and to get a graph out of that. So the LPS graphs are an example of that, and they've also been general. LPS graphs have also been generalized by Jordan and Leavenay, and the Pizer graph, which is elliptic curves, we've also generalized in joint work with the same authors to higher dimensional superspecial abelian varieties, and you can get Ramanujan graphs from those constructions as well. But you can see both of the constructions as coming from the same thing by considering the description of the Pizer graphs in terms of maximal orders and quaternion algebras. So back to the LPS construction. The LPS construction is really nice because it has a description as a Cayley graph. So they write down a group, which is the matrices SL2Z, and they give a recipe for how to move around, what the vertices are in terms of matrices in this group, and what a generating set, which a Cayley graph is just a graph coming from a group where two elements of the group are connected if you get from one to the other by multiplying by one of the elements in the generating set. And so the LPS graph can actually be described as a Cayley graph. And so the implementation of the hash function coming from the LPS graph is much more efficient than that coming from the Pizer graph that I already showed you. But then the problem also has to be, the hard problem for finding collisions also has to be phrased differently. I'm kind of out of time, so I'm not going to get into that. But I just wanted to mention that this is the LPS graph is the work that's most closely related to the construction of Zemmer and Tillich from 94. And Joie and Kiskaté have been following up on this direction, trying to figure out the best choices of generators and such for making hash functions from something like the LPS graph. Okay, so that's all I wanted to say. Thank you very much for listening. So the output would also be 256 bits, and the reason is that the J invariants and everything are a priori defined over FP squared, so you'd think maybe 512 bits, but there's really only roughly P over 12 distinct supersingular elliptic curves, and so you don't want to output something of size 2 log P when really you only have a content which is log P. So we actually use just like a linear congruential hash function to move the output from that domain of FP squared into FP. Well, that's a question of whether this is an injective map, but I mean probabilistically it's there's certain choices that you could make that would be bad, but if you take a random choice, it shouldn't be bad. Well, there you need to be taking a prime, let's say, maybe 1,024 bits, something like that. And so the problem with the output there is that you need something like 4 log p bits for the output. And so, you know, that's most probably way too long unless you truncate it. You don't want a 4,000 bits. Output probably for your hash version.
There's also another class that's combined with the carrot graph. Have you considered those?
Actually, we thought about
based on the finite upper half thing.
Yeah, so So we've thought about that a little bit, not so much in this context, but those can also be fit into families of graphs in a kind of a tower, in the same way that this the Peiser graph can generalize to super special abelian varieties in higher dimensions. And so we thought about it in the context of towers, but we didn't think about it so much in the context of collision resistance, because so the operations, I believe, are just multiplications in the finite field, and so it might be end up being equivalent to discrete log or something like that, which would mean taking a larger output.
Okay.
And two things, just to
comment,
is oh yes, I'm sorry. Yeah, should have said that. Yeah, oh, the zigzag.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, both of these properties are important. The expansion is related to the pseudo-randomness of the output, and then the girth is more related to the difficulty of finding collision resistance, but that's the question, is that, I mean, these graphs have very large girth. Great, but so that intuitively makes you think that it's harder to find collisions when you know that there's no small cycles. So we start with that as a property, but do we really know that, you know, it's any harder to find collisions? I mean, we're just essentially taking random walks right now to find collisions anyway. So can you prove that the having large girth, you know, makes it harder to find collisions? Yes.
Have you thought about these null variables occur in a varying L, so sort of a bit like a speed calibrate technique of jumping around the uncertainty graph?
Yes. We thought about that a little. Actually, David Chow did some work with Steve Miller and Ramanujan Venkatesan, and there what you need to do is to, like you said, vary the L so that you can even get something connected. It's not connected to begin with. And so I don't really know whether you would get any better properties from using that, but one of the issues is certainly that that is more related to the discrete log problem in the class group. So I think that is kind of what would need to be analyzed there. Are you, you know, if you're working in different class groups or how they would interact, or I don't know. Oh, that would be interesting if it were relays of VSC. So you're thinking like with x squared plus y squared equals x squared plus 1 or something like that, which is like an involution or something?
No, I'm thinking of not that one, I mean, that doesn't have an endomorphism word that we use too, but there are other CM curves like that that have two endomorphisms that we use too. So if you look at those points, your graph would actually have two edges from this vertex to itself and another one going in.
Yeah, so that's where we actually use the property of the endomorphism ring being in maximal order. What you can do is you can actually put conditions on P. I only set P congruent to 1 mod 12 to make it undirected, but you can put much more stringent conditions on P, which we've worked out for like the smallest cases, to make it so that there are no endomorphisms of small degree for degree up to some bound. And you do that by saying, well, if there were one of degree 2, then it would give this solution to the representability by the norm form, and you know we can make it so that such a thing is not represented by the norm form. So we've been able to do that up to a point, and the way it would affect the construction is it would be you just can't take any P, random P, you know, 1 mod 12. You need to take a P that's in the congruence class that, you know, that we've determined. So that's a way to avoid very small cycles anyway. Yeah, you definitely don't want to have endomorphism degree 2. Mm-hmm. I'm getting confused between the ordinary and the supersingular right now. But because normally the L torsion would be defined over an extension of degree, generically L squared, and P is already large. But here L is very small. L is 2, or maybe slightly bigger. So it shouldn't be a problem that it's, you know, a small extension of the base field.